You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, and then moving on to the September 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Place Invaders by Justin Heckert, with illustrations by Quick Honey. Tanya English and her angry companion operated without inhibition that what they were doing might be suspicious. A few days after their Grumpy Bob's antics, they arrived at Game Over in Union, Missouri, this time perhaps slightly wiser about getting paid. Again, they tried to sell the Flintstones game, rumored and debunked by collectors to have been a rental exclusive at Blockbuster Video. The owner of Game Over, listed in police documents as Matthew Maynard, eventually made a deal. He shelled out cash for Flintstones and also Contraforce, Military versus Terrorist, 1992, the rarest and final game in the NES Contra trilogy, both complete in box. But Maynard only spent $450, thousands less than the market price. When a Trade and Games regular saw the new merch, he recognized those titles. Brassard drove to Game Over to talk to Maynard, who said, according to Brassard, and which Brassard repeated to the police, something to the effect of a little old lady sold him the games from her closet. Lunsford also went to the store and spoke to Maynard, then took the games back to the station. Between the accounts from Grumpy Bob's and Game Over, Lunsford had a decent idea of who she was looking for. English's Facebook page was public and revealed her relationship with a man named Damon Jackson. That man seemed to match the description of a white male who tried to sell games to yet another used game store, a regional chain called Slackers, on more than one occasion at two different stores. In the first incident at the South County Center store, Jackson, partially hidden under a baseball cap, stopped at the threshold of the store's entrance while a female companion, not English, approached the counter, looking over her shoulder at Jackson as though he were her coach. She had so many rare games in her bag, really old games, with the manual and box, that it startled the manager, Matt Ravis. Atari 2600 games like Tapper, Bartender versus Patrons, 1983, and Mr. Doze. No one ever brought in one of those games, much less a purseful. According to Ravis, she said they were her son's games. Next illustration shows an old game player assembly with cartridges rated. Among the collection were Nintendo, Sega, and Atari games. Ravis offered her a couple $100, a lowball figure she accepted. After she and the man by the door left together, he Googled the name of each game he'd purchased, plus St. Louis, and eventually found Brassard's Facebook post. Ravis's boss, the owner of Slackers, realized he was in possession of stolen property, and soon Lunsford had taken those games into evidence. By this point, the detective had reclaimed about half of the 120 stolen games. But none of the games could be called Cherry anymore. No, these games had the same titles as the ones Brassard lost, but they had been mauled, or in some cases destroyed, as though the perpetrator realized the only way he could actually sell them without being caught was to cut their value. Broussard's air raid cartridge and his complete inbox Little Samson turned up damaged at two different game stores in Las Vegas. But Broussard didn't get them back. One of the owners told him, "You have insurance. Don't involve me. F off," when Broussard called after seeing his games for sale online. Others were more helpful. When it comes to the bigger collections, and when something gets stolen, we collectors are like individual fingers, and when connected, we can form a fist, says John Hancock, a retro game enthusiast with his own significant collection. When something shitty like this happens, collectors work with one another. When Jackson went to establishments closer to home, like Prestige Electronics and Arch City Gaming Company in Bridgeton, Missouri, he didn't bother to disguise himself. And he'd apparently never truly considered the proximity of the stores to each other, or that the owners could possibly know one another. This was no criminal mastermind. He always had some bullshit story, says Broussard. His caper extended in scope, but the lack of creativity ultimately did him in. Jackson drove to Denver in a pickup truck, and the clerk working at Level 7 Games saw it in the parking lot. "He told me I just had them," says John Young, the Level 7 clerk. "He had some crazy rare stuff, like bubble bath babes in the box, games that we'd never seen before, and he didn't give a shit at all." Again, Jackson declined to provide any ID. While Young pretended to look up prices, he had no intention of purchasing any of the games. He told a colleague to take a picture of Jackson's license plate. Young remembered reading about trade-in games, and he called Broussard. That was December 13, 2019. Jackson's story about the games wasn't that unusual, and he told the various clerks that he'd never played them, which rang true. "Because he didn't know shit about them," says John Mertz, the owner of Bodak's Games in St. Louis, another stop on Jackson's list. "It didn't flip a switch in my head. It didn't trigger that it was the stuff from Jackson's heist. Or rather, Jason's heist." Jackson had a box copy of Bubble Bobble Part 2, Bob and Bub vs. Skulls, 1993, and a copy of the NES game Worm, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Combat Chick vs. Subterranean Humanoids, 1991, that had also been in the safe, but this one was ripped out of its plastic WATA-graded case. What Mertz didn't know at the time was that Broussard was staking Jackson out. "I paid Jackson in cash," Mertz says. "We posted the games on Facebook, and Jason came in with a police officer and said, 'This stuff is mine.' So when Jackson called Mertz and said he was going to return with more games, this time three undercover agents were waiting, dressed like civilians, idly rifling through Magic, the Gathering cards, and NES cartridges. As Jackson was leaving the counter, the officers descended. He began cursing," Mertz says. "These are mine. I've had them forever. This is effing bullshit. Then I have to go to the bathroom." Jackson clutched his chest when they were putting on handcuffs. The officers had to call an ambulance to the store. Broussard was sitting just outside in his truck, biting his fingernails. Jackson was arrested for possession of stolen property, taken to a local hospital, and released. After the stakeout, Broussard went to the police station with the undercover officers. The men couldn't get over any of it. The ordinary break-in that was also historic and kind of hilarious. And there were NES porn games, really? And so Broussard pulled up videos of peekaboo poker on YouTube to show them that it was true. Jackson was arrested again in February 2020 for driving a car with expired plates and then charged with one count of burglary and three counts of stealing, one for over $25,000, two for amounts over $750. By then, Lunsford had enough evidence to pinpoint him at Trade and Games at the time of the theft, using his phone data from a GPS warrant request. for what is likely the most valuable video game theft in history, Jackson was sentenced to 17 years in prison, deferred on felony probation. Part of his probation agreement depended upon his providing information on the rest of the games and paying around $24,000 in restitution. Charges were never filed against English or the other woman in connection with the case. Broussard used to walk to the back room of the store in the morning just so he could see his games. To behold them was to breathe a little easier, never mind the paperwork growing on his desk, the bathroom trash can overflowing with wadded-up paper towels, the mini-fridge in need of more Diet Cokes. Walking slowly into the mass of his collection, he could gaze on the colorful spines of the boxes, alphabetized in congruency on shelves that stretched the walls. Nothing else ever made him feel such ambition. The years required, the dedication. How he'd sought to find not only the games, but the ones in the very best condition. He'd brought his fiancée, Hope, to the store one evening, held her hand, and took her into the vault. Everything lit up, and he showed me around, and it was overwhelming, says Hope, now his wife. This is how she first understood the pride of the man she was going to marry, the type of collector who'd gone after it all. He showed her ROB, Robotic Operating Buddy, the 1986 NES robot console in its sought-after box. Esoterica, like a clean copy of the Outback Joey exercise game for the Genesis, Kangaroo vs. Calories, 1993. And his Cherry Rampage 2 Universal Tour for Nintendo 64, Giant Animals vs. Buildings, 1999, that came with a plush rat keychain. He drove her to Tennessee to pick up an Atari 2600 mall kiosk from the late 1970s, to conventions like the Midwest Gaming Classic in Wisconsin. He knew all the vendors and toured her through the booths full of games. When he asked her to marry him and she said yes, his friend presented them with a custom NES painted bridal white with his and hers controllers. Did she know about the games in the safe? Duh. Cheetah Man 2, Final Fight Guy, Hagen for Super Nintendo, not only his work, but his life's work, which had become a part of her own. Their kids from different marriages played at the store, at home. After he received some of the stolen games from police evidence in three batches, the last of which had come in a Huggies box, he set them out on the table with a white photo backdrop where he usually took pictures of the store's games before putting them online to sell so he could see them better. The copy of Tapper that had been sold to Slackers, Cherry in the safe, looked like a car had backed over it. Stuntman, Guy vs. Laws of Physics, 1983. A rare game by the Panda Company. And Quadron, Runts vs. Captors, 1983. Jackson had unsealed those from the ancient factory shrink wrap. The Atari 2600 game Boing, Bubble vs. Squares, 1983, complete in box, was now flattened, the cardboard furrowed. His copy of Guardian, Planet vs. Ship, 1982, gashed, where an old price sticker had been on the top right, untouched from whoever purchased it long ago. Jackson had eradicated the serial numbers of the Parnesian porn trinity, Bubble Bath Babes, Bubbles vs. Gravity, plus a naked woman, Hot Slots, Slot Machine vs. Lust, plus, eventually, a naked woman, Peekaboo Poker, The Hand You're Dealt vs. a Naked Woman's, with what Broussard imagined had to be steel wool or a belt sander. He's still trying to get back to where he was before, says Hope. It's like looking at a piece of art for him. You wouldn't want to see a Picasso have a scratch on it. And basically, that's how I would describe these to him, as his Picasso. I'd rather not have them back at all, he told Hope. Broussard hid the list of the games he'd made for insurance, $92,000 in the end, at the bottom of a drawer. He placed the Huggies box with about 40 of the games he'd gotten back on the floor of the vault room, away from view. Broussard has thought about trying to market his tragedy, he confesses. Even damaged, maybe they have value. The heist aftermath coincided with the pandemic. 2 years of having way too much time by himself to obsess about it. He'd created a world of games to exist everywhere he could set his eyes, and now, in lockdown, he was constantly trying to avert them. He had never collected for money. He wanted to own the games as a grown-up, because he played them as a child. But money was one of the only things he saw now when he went into the back room. How could he see anything else? It at least quantified his emotional loss. He sat down at his desk and wrote about how much he thought his entire collection would bring. $2 million? Three? Maybe it's time to sell, he said to Gilbalt. The first video game Broussard ever got was called Megamania, Spaceship vs. Hamburgers, 1982, for the Atari 2600. It was a Christmas present, the year he was 10. He'd torn the cartridge out of the box, forever diminishing the game's value, of course not knowing the collector he'd become. Then the rudimentary piece of media impressed upon him the vaguest notion of his future life. Games would turn out to be connections to the past, to iterations of himself at different points. The 20-something who toted around a Nintendo 64, working for a plane cleaning company. The dad playing Wii with his daughter and son, who would grow up hanging around at the store. People remember doing certain things with friends and family, he says. I think that's what video games do, and that's what makes them what they are. The first game he purchased on eBay to start his collection back in his early 20s was Megamania Cherry for $10. When Broussard left Missouri this past fall and moved to Florida, he didn't take that game with him, or any of the others. He couldn't find the energy to alphabetically display cartridges on the walls of the new condo. There's not a single game visible in the place. He still owns Trade and Games, but Gilbalt has the keys. It's a sort of semi-retirement, Broussard jokes. He's got a job in gaming at a company called CGC that has made its name in comics and coins, and he'll spearhead the public launch of its game grading arm late this year. He and Hope are car enthusiasts, and so they drive their Jeep to car shows and to the flea market in Fort Myers. Someone manning a retro game booth even recognized him once. Aren't you the guy from the robbery? That was the iteration of Broussard now, the collector who had his favorite prizes stolen, the mother of all game collections, in the safe. He was now just trying to forget.
Thank you.
That concludes the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. We now move to the September 2022 issue, which features Lewis Hamilton on the cover. Now here's this month's editor's letter with a photograph by Mark Seliger of Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. Of all the surprises in Chris Heath's mesmerizing cover profile of the Formula One icon Lewis Hamilton, the one that charmed me most is that Hamilton dislikes driving. Not on the race course, to be clear. There, he channels the joy and dedication of an athlete who found the exact thing he was born to do. One thinks of Serena Williams on the tennis court, Simone Biles on the gymnastics floor. No, this was about being hamstrung by two-way traffic and junctions and impatient road hogs, navigating the twisting roads outside the picturesque town of Aix in the south of France, where he talked to Chris about his tumultuous season and what's to come. Formula One is huge in Europe and growing its profile in the U.S., thanks in part to Netflix's gripping series Drive to Survive. And Hamilton is in a class of one when it comes to his racing bona fides, but also his grace and sportsmanship in victory and in defeat. Here, he speaks without reservation of his disappointment after a controversial call that cost him a deserved win, of the friends who pulled him out of despair, and of the fortitude that brought him to the pinnacle of achievement in the first place. The same fortitude mixed with a healthy dose of rebellious spirit that now carries him through. The pleasures and personalities in this September issue abound. A star-studded feature on Mario Carbone and his celebrity magnet restaurants. The first interview with Audrey Gelman since her dizzyingly successful startup, The Wing, suffered its equally dizzying decline and fall. An archive dive into irresistible, never-before-seen correspondence from Eve Babbitts to literary frenemy Joan Didion, and an in-depth interview with post-primetime Rachel Maddow, who is downshifting her presence as the face of MSNBC at arguably the precise moment when her audience needs her most, on the eve of extremely consequential midterm elections. On that note, as much as we love to look forward to the fall slate, it feels particularly important this September to acknowledge the darkness preceding it. The summer of 2022 was marked by a series of Supreme Court decisions that fundamentally altered our cultural and political landscape, from Miranda rights to the EPA to bodily autonomy. The shock of the Dobbs decision, if I tried to diagnose my own, had less to do with the actual ruling. Conservative legislators and judges have been chipping away at Roe for decades, and I wish I could say I was surprised that candidates for the highest bench lied about their commitment to upholding precedent. Nor is it surprising, in the arc of American history, to confront the fact that certain classes of people are afforded fewer rights and protections than others. What struck me was the backslide, the idea that for my 49 years as an American woman, born the day after Roe v. Wade was decided, I possessed an agency over my body that, depending on what state they live in, my nieces and granddaughter might not. And further, the notion, offensive in the extreme, that the Supreme Court now presumed to frame my own relationship to my body differently. In constitutional terms, we have recognized more rights over the last 230 years, not taken them away. And so the decision overturning Roe feels bizarre, not only in its feeble originalist claims, as if the founders were sparing bandwidth for the privacy or privileges of any women, but in its reversal of a trajectory toward greater, if always imperfect, equality of opportunity for all citizens. On the day of the abortion decision, I happened to be flying to London, and things looked even worse from abroad, because, as I heard from everyone who asked me about it, the United States had revealed itself to be not a beacon, but a backward force. We will have more to say on these topics throughout the fall. For this issue, Christian Farias takes on the subject of the Supreme Court's current war on democracy, the way the conservative wing of the court is helping to dismantle democratic apparatuses against popular will and even reason. With scant respect for history and precedent, they use the blunt tools at their disposal to derail our future. Here are some of the issue's contributors. Chris Heath, Keys to the Kingdom. When athletes don't seem to have too much to say, I sometimes wonder whether it's because the core of what they do is nonverbal, or whether it's more that no one thinks to ask, says British-born, Brooklyn-based contributor Chris Heath. Lewis Hamilton has a remarkable story, one he is clearly still pondering himself. If you're truly prepared to listen, he'll tell you plenty. Nicole Chapoteau, All About Eve. We shot on a beautiful farm estate in Cold Spring, New York. It was such a treat for me as I grew up in the area, says Vanity Fair fashion director Nicole Chapoteau, who styled Eve Jobs. She absolutely loves clothes and wanted to try on everything. Her playlist was epic, and she even made a funny joke about supporting the family business. Emily Jane Fox, Vintage Audrey. To prepare for her Audrey Gelman profile, national correspondent Emily Jane Fox boned up on accountability politics and media treatment of female founders. She and Gelman talked about everything from Trump-era pop feminism to cottagecore. It was a masterclass in world-building tied to cultural taste and political moment meeting, she says. Lily Annerlich, Fast Company. I thought I knew everything about Eve Babbitts, and then her sister, Mirandy, found these boxes with letters, journals, photos, says Vanity Fair contributing editor Lily Annerlich, who is working on a revised edition of her book on the subject, Hollywood's Eve, Eve Babbitts and the Secret History of L.A., for Scribner. I now understand Eve, Joan Didion, too, in a whole new way. It's thrilling. Nate Freeman, Chef's Kiss. Art columnist and brand new dad, Nate Freeman, first saw the Cult of Carbone in action last December at the restaurant in Florida's South Beach. The frenzy during Art Basel transcended spicy rigatoni, he says. It was a cultural phenomenon. Freeman, who splits his time between the East Village and the Catskills, marvels at Carbone's empire. It's as if the rich and powerful simply are not aware that other places exist to get dinner. behind the cover. In April, Vanity Fair took over an acclaimed Zaha Hadid-designed building in Manhattan to create a multidimensional candy-colored world for Formula One superstar Lewis Hamilton. The West Chelsea apartment tower rises elegantly above the elevated High Line, with dynamic curves and open flowing rooms, the fluid futuristic hallmarks of Hadid's work. Photographer Adrian Raquel set the lighting to cinematic opulence. "I wanted the imagery to ooze impeccable style and bravado," she says, "and to really capture Lewis from a new gaze." As Chris Heath reveals in his profile of Hamilton, off the racetrack, he is a cautious and courteous driver who dislikes driving. But there is one car he has always been drawn to, a 1989 Lamborghini Countach, infamously featured in Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street. Set designer Stefan Beckman managed to track one down for the occasion. Throughout the portfolio, stylist Eric McNeil cut a swath through this season's most celebrated looks. "We spoke of our shared love for things like Japanese fashion and black designers," McNeil says. Lewis passionately insisted we have them included in the shoot. For the cover image, the team constructed a stage in the middle of the indoor pool. Hamilton walked onto a floating platform, dressed head to toe in Valentino pink. Never mind those pant hems. In the photos, Lewis Hamilton with photographer Adrian Raquel, posing with a 1989 Lamborghini Countach, capturing the cover shot. Hamilton and Raquel, Hamilton with stylist Eric McNeil, set designer Stefan Beckman. Okay, before we move on, I must correct my pronunciation of the car. It's Lamborghini Countach. Now on to the vanities. And we have a photograph by Nick Riley Bentham of Tuso Mebedu, who prepares for battle in the Woman King. Now this from Britt Hindemuth, Crown Jewel, as Nawi and the Woman King, Tuso Mebedu channels the power of an Agoji warrior. Tuso Mebedu broke hearts and raked in accolades as Cora in Barry Jenkins' limited series, The Underground Railroad, based on Colson Whitehead's book. Now, the rising South African star makes her big screen debut in Gina Prince Bythewood's historical drama, The Woman King, opposite Viola Davis. Being surrounded by such strong, fierce women, she smiles and pauses. I'm looking forward to the press tour. Born in KwaZulu-Natal, the land of the Zulus, she's the first artist in her family. Because my parents were born during the apartheid era, my mother wanted to be a geologist, but she wasn't allowed. She lost her mother young, so Mebedu's grandmother raised her and her sister. My grand passed 3 days before my on-screen debut. After graduating from drama school in Johannesburg, I couldn't afford to fail and go back home. It was not an option. Her big break came in the form of the series Istunzi. I hadn't worked for 6 straight months. I'd gone through depression as a result. I was like, if I don't get this, take me, Jesus. She laughs. I'm dramatic. After 2 consecutive International Emmy nominations, she auditioned for The Underground Railroad. At her final callback, she cried so much, her contact lens flipped inside out. I hope they don't want another take, she thought. I practically ran out. Years later, the newfound Angelino and Jenkins remain close. I bother him at random times. I invite myself to use the pool. I don't even need you to be at the house. She turned down a major franchise. Which one? I can't say. To do The Woman King. The film has an all-star cast, which Mebedu says are all introverts, except for John Boyega, who is a complete clown and a joy to work with. She and Davis formed a particular bond. Viola did say that if her story was turned into a biopic, she would love me to play her. I said, I can audition? And she said, no, Tuso can play. I said, oh. Now she's producing with a deal at Paramount Plus to make socially conscious content. I want to create opportunities for other people, and I'm grateful I'm able to. due time, black filmmakers star in a new exhibit at L.A.'s Academy Museum by Johanna Desta. In the photo, the Nicholas brothers in a scene from Stormy Weather, 1943. When visitors step into Regeneration, Black Cinema, 1898 to 1971, they will see rare objects like Lena Horne's gown from Stormy Weather, clips from buried blaxploitation films like Black Chariot, and home movies from the likes of Cab Calloway. From the onset, there has been black participation in cinema, co-curator Ray Combs says. The show has been 5 years in the making, says co-curator Doris Berger, along the way shaped by advisors like Ava DuVernay and influenced by research trips to the south of France, where the curators visited Josephine Baker's preserved castle. Regeneration was sparked by the historic 2017 rediscovery of Something Good, Negro Kiss, a short clip from 1898 depicting two black actors tenderly kissing, which will show beside Glenn Ligon's Double America II neon work to create a dialogue between historic and contemporary black art, the past stepping into its rightful place in the present. Okay, folks, the Lamborghini Countach is waiting, so I'm riding off into the sunset. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.